Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us on the line today from Cote d'Ivoire is Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi, who is the Special Gender Envoy at the African Development Bank. She previously held the position of Director of the United Nations Development Programme's Democratic Governance Group, overseeing the organization's related strategic and policy work in 197 countries and territories around the globe. She was also appointed by the Secretary General of the United Nations as a board member of the United Nations Institute for Training and Research. Prior to joining the United Nations, she served as Minister for Public Service and Administration in South Africa from 1999 to 2008 and as Minister of Welfare and Population Development between 1996 to 1999. She also served as National Deputy Elections Coordinator for the African National Congress from 1993 and 1994 in the lead-up to South Africa's first democratic elections of April 1994. Welcome once again to the show. It's an absolute pleasure to have you.
It's good to be online with you, as always. And yes, I'm looking forward to this interview.
Recently, between the 9th and 10th of June, there was an Infrastructure on Africa 2016 conference, which was held at the Sandton Convention Center in Johannesburg, and it incorporated the Africa Inclusive Infrastructure Forum from the African Development Bank. Can you please share with us what this event was all about?
For the past 5 years, there's been the Infrastructure Africa Summit that takes place annually. And this year we thought to go into partnership with CIEMSA and have a particular focus on inclusive infrastructure, because we felt that there's a tendency to assume that infrastructure is gender neutral. And we've also seen the consideration and engagement of women and gender itself essentially from the perspective of women as downstream beneficiaries. So the infrastructure summit was to look at how we could turn around what the perception is about infrastructure, bearing in mind that women represent 52% of the regional member countries of the African Development Bank, but also of the population of Africa.
You're absolutely right. And I consider that there's this value chain of infrastructure which has tremendous long-term effects. And when you were talking about women almost being at the end of that value chain, it's as if they are, we think of it as passive beneficiaries on completion of services. So once the road's been built, the facilities have been provided. But there also needs to be another component of active beneficiaries. So to allow women, I think, to be participating in the shaping of the infrastructure to service their needs, and also in the payment and in terms of the orchestration of these facilities and their construction, whether it's building, becoming architects, engineers.
Absolutely. I think you've really put your finger on it. So I'd want to start out with where you started. And this is the fact that women are, well, firstly, they're responsible for 75% of the agricultural labor force. We know that they produce up to 80% of food outputs, yet they earn between 30 and 50% less than men. They also work 50% longer hours than men, and they control less than 25% of agricultural land holding. We also know that they are 28% less likely to own a formal bank account. And they form about 75% of the poor and vulnerable populations in regional member countries, or let's say African countries. I think that will suffice. Now, I said during the summit, and I will repeat it today, that the women have almost become the living infrastructure on the continent, in the sense that women carry firewood where there is no energy, and women carry water and so on. We've also seen the high levels of exposure to smoke inhalation, indoor pollution, and so on. And this is what we want to turn around. Now, for that turnaround, there's a number of things to happen. First and foremost, and you've mentioned this, we'd like to ensure that our girls and boys remain in school across the African continent. We'd not want girls to be married off at an early age. And here we're talking about teens and preteens. And it's important, as we keep them in schools, also to ensure that we bring them into the STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and maths. And we need to create an environment that will encourage girls and boys to remain in these courses. As we speak today, I mean, you attest to the fact that when you look at South Africa, we're not doing well on maths, and this is for boys and girls. And we need to turn it around because we want women and the younger people to come in and own construction companies. We want them to be able to run the trucking companies that are taking produce to our mines and so on. We want them to be involved in the large energy projects across the continent. And we have examples of what such projects should look like.
Can you please tell us a bit more about some of these projects?
Some examples on how we'd envisage an inclusive infrastructure project, and particularly looking at a road project. And I'd like to take you to Ghana. In Ghana, in the northern region, which is one of the most impoverished and isolated part of the country, poor infrastructure, road infrastructure, had negative socioeconomic impacts. And women and girls face walking long distances to get potable water. Even their access to education and health service centers was really difficult. And the bank was involved in the funding of the Fufusa Salwa Road and Community Development Project. This road is and was important for the region, because it's the shortest route between Tamale, which is the capital of the northern region, and the largest, Tamale is the largest city in northern Ghana, and Wa is the capital of the upper west region. When there wasn't this road, it resulted in problems in terms of regional integration and cooperation between Ghana and its northern neighbors, and these neighbors are Cote d'Ivoire, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, because cross-border traffic was limited. The north-south corridor transporters couldn't rely on the road because it increased the travel time, and it was just a difficult part of the country to travel across.
And roads are really our physical distribution centers. They're the arterial routes to move traffic, whether it's human, whether it's goods or agriculture.
Exactly. And this is precisely the point I want to get to. So through the building of this road, as this project was developed, there was a clear sense that we're looking at the road economy. We're not just building a road between point A and point B. And with this road economy, we have to take into account agriculture in that part of the country and look at feeder roads that were required to bring the produce from farms to markets. The second issue is that the project also created a 147.5-kilometer ring road between Fufusa and Salwa. And it had ancillary works components, so there was water supply, there was the rehabilitation of schools and health sectors, constructions of market vehicle or lorry parks, improvement of tourist attraction. But above all, in that region, only 30% of households had access to potable water. And this construction resulted in the journey from the Mongo hospital to Tamale that took 4 hours before the construction of the road. It now just takes over an hour. This road and this example is just to show that infrastructure, when it is properly planned actually changes the lives of people. So it's not just the road that fast cars move or trucks move by, but it's one that links hospitals, schools, produce to markets and all. Yeah. And this is what we want to see. And that's why we also believe that as we engage in infrastructure projects as the African Development Bank, we've got to have consultations with the communities in order that they can advise on their broader needs. And the planning is done in such a way that it includes us and takes into account those needs.
And with that, it's a whole construction of an ecosystem. So it's not just a case of we're building a road. It's building in the other infrastructure components. As you mentioned, we could look at the hospital facilities, the schools, all part of this network. And I'm reminded from some of the comments that you mentioned earlier in terms of the poverty levels with women across the continent, that when you have this reduction, so for instance, when you were talking about the hospital, what would typically take a four-hour trip has now been reduced to 25% of that time to just an hour, that women are also discriminated against, especially poor women, in terms of cost of time and cost of opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And this is precisely why we also look at the whole infrastructure process or the whole inclusive infrastructure initiative as such that will allow women to free up time so that they are then able to look at other activities, social activities, they can look at personal development, education, etc. I can give you a very different example from another part of the continent. And here I like to reflect on a project that we are going to start that's in the Darfur area. And this is West Kordofan. In that particular area, the bank is laying out as is supporting a project for water and sanitation infrastructure. And in that area, girls and boys are actually involved in either taking cattle. The boys will take the cattle to water points and have to walk kilometers at a time. The girls need to draw water through Essien bags, and they also walk 10 kilometers, and that impacts on their education. And through this water and sanitation project, it will bring water closer and into communities. And we see a community of about 300,000 people being serviced and also providing an opportunity for the girls and boys to stay in school instead of walking distances to draw water or look for water and all. So you know, issues that we tend to take for granted in more urban settings, and here I talk about formal urban settings, not informal settings, those things we take for granted is not that accessible out there. And again, as you say, it impacts on women's time because in essence, as I said in the beginning, women tend to be the living infrastructure on the continent. The women and girls draw the water. They are the ones who go and look for firewood. They are the ones who need to cook. They are the ones who are the caregivers. And we want a situation where you have women and girls being educated in order that their children have a greater opportunity for the kind of future we need. And hence, as we look at our national plans, we need to take this into account and understand that we're building, as you said, ecosystems that will allow our communities to have greater levels of engagement that's to the benefit of the communities, families, and in overall to the country as a whole.
And I think one of the really important points that you've highlighted is from a community point of view. So looking at it from building for what those community needs. And I think that, you know, we're here talking, I'm in South Africa, you're in Cote d'Ivoire, and we're in wonderful environments, that we can't underestimate how many people are in rural societies. I was at a conference recently where we spoke about Uganda having 83% rural population. I think in South Africa, we're probably, in terms of our population, that 50% are in rural areas. So it really is a big proportion of the continent that needs these infrastructure components.
Yeah, I'd agree with you completely. And as we're speaking, it brings to mind, the whole issue of the Uganda full water supply and sanitation program that we're working with government on. And it's part of the government's efforts to achieve sustainable provision of safe water and hygienic sanitation. And this is based on management responsibility and ownership by users. Now there, as you stated, 77% of the rural populations and 90% of small towns, the intention was to reach them by last year. And the project itself is reducing the prevalence of waterborne diseases, improving school retention for girls, increasing productivity time of girls and women due to savings in water collection time. And this in turn will have a positive impact on health, poverty rate, gender and education. Now, in this instance here, women are involved in the water management processes because they're in key managerial positions on the water and sanitation boards. We're looking at staff being trained in gender mainstreaming to collate gender disaggregated data. So it comes back again to the point you raised. We take these issues for granted, but for real change to be seen, we've got to ensure that we include everyone in the population. And this is where we link it to the global sustainable development goals that were adopted by the United Nations. And mind you, all heads of state and government have signed off on it. And on that SDG, there are three that one can directly link our discussion to.
And which ones are they?
Yeah, it's SDG number 5 is the one on gender equality. SDG number 6 is for water. SDG number 7 is on energy. SDG number 9 is on industry, innovation, and infrastructure. And then, it actually cuts across all. Because when you look at 11, SDG number 11 is sustainable cities and communities. 15 is life on land. 14 is life below the water. 13 is climate action. And 12 is responsible consumption and production. I've spoken about 6, which is clean water and sanitation, 7, which is energy, and it's about affordable and clean energy. 8 is decent work and economic growth. And so it goes on. And we can also talk about education. SDG number 4 is quality education. Number 3 is good health and well-being. And 2, you spoke about poverty, the first one, no poverty, and the second one is zero hunger. So again, I bring all 17 together and say that if we really want to transform our world, the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development through the 17 goals are quite key. And Amalaya, as we speak, it's really about communities looking at what they should do and how they can contribute to the attainment of these goals. And for governments at the national, provincial, and subnational level to look at what they're doing in contributing towards this agenda. And the Sustainable Development Goals is intertwined to Agenda 2063 of the African Union. And as you know, Africa was the one region that actually had an Africa-wide platform of its commitments to SDGs. Now, South Africa, and you probably reflecting on this quite a bit, is going to local government elections on, I believe it's the 3rd of August.
Yes, in August.
And as there's local government elections coming up, I mean, it's a no-brainer that any platform has to have these goals, because at the end of the day, this is what transforms people's lives at the local level.
It does, and I think part of the issue is that people have to stop thinking of them as isolated and in their own silos. Yes, they've been allocated specific numbers because they need to be fulfilled. But the reality is they're all integrated, and to build a sustainable society, you need to have this interplay between each one of those components so that the whole system works effectively.
I would agree with you completely. That's why I said that whatever we do, we see it as cross-cutting. That's the need in our endeavor to take forward our focus on inclusive infrastructure that we're talking about today. And I'd want to again go to another country on the continent and another project. And this is the Morocco Warfazad project, which is the largest concentrated solar power complex in the world. Now, the first phase of this project was launched in February this year with 160 megawatts through what's referred to as Nur 1 at this plant, and there's three phases to it. In addition to the electricity that will be generated and the jobs that will be created through this solar power complex, we also see the integration of women, and this was planned as part of it. So the project includes an important component for women to strengthen their socioeconomic integration in the region and promote their employability. And the project deployment includes training programs that's aimed at enhancing the employability of women and their social and economic empowerment. So thanks for giving me the way in by talking about the cross-cutting nature of the sustainable goals itself, but it's also how is it reflected through practical action.
Today we're talking to Geraldine Fraser-Moliketti, who is the Special Gender Envoy at the African Development Bank. We've spoken about some of these really significant, I'd say, physical infrastructure projects. So whether it was Ghana with building the road, Darfur with the water and sanitation project, Uganda with the water supply, and Morocco with the solar power. But one of the things that I was thinking about was, and again, this is possibly because of thinking it through the lens of having access to other opportunities, is that I almost think that our internet, Wi-Fi, that all of this connectivity it's an essential part of my infrastructure and the world that I live in. And I think increasingly in terms of being able to access people in isolated regions, specifically in rural communities, by being able to tap into a Wi-Fi system. I mean, Tshwane has free Wi-Fi for its citizens. What do you think we're doing in terms of progressing in that dimension?
You know, Africa has actually had quite a boom over recent years when it came to the whole issue of mobile technology. So moving away from the larger Wi-Fi and broadband issue is, if you look at a country like Kenya, for example, Kenya is using mobile phones. And here we're not only talking about smartphones, where women are actually able to engage in their financial transactions.
If we think about in Uganda and Kenya in particular, I think put together, combined, as two countries, they account for the highest mobile money users in the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we saw M-Pesa take off, and we saw that women and men, young people, are able to transact on their mobile phones. So banking is done. You see transacting taking place. There's a much greater movement of money, and it's also making both banks and telecoms rethink the way in which they are functioning at this point in time. I mean, we can't look at banks in the way we used to. If you look at East Africa, between those countries, they're able to make phone calls without any extra charges. So the mobile phones don't have roaming charges in the East African community. You know, it's there's a clear link up. Rwanda's leading quite a bit in terms of this use and bringing down the costs when you look at shared networks and all. So there's really interesting things happening on the continent. I think SADC, Southern Africa, can learn quite a bit from what's happening in East Africa.
I agree with you. I think that there are so many shared learnings, and also there's just such positivity. If you can reduce the cost of communications, it allows the flow of information, especially in terms of opportunities for trade.
Absolutely. I mean, something that's quite different but also linked, when you look at the whole regional integration issue, we were informed at the summit as well, and we know this from the work that the bank is doing with the African Union and the Economic Community for Africa, that at this point in time, there's greater movement of people and goods, you know, within that East African community. And what happens is that if there's a citizen of any one of the East African countries, whether it's an engineer or accountant or whatever the skill set that's required, when that is required in any one of those countries, if you are Rwandan and you're an engineer, construction engineer, you're required in Uganda, you don't need to apply for a work permit in Uganda. You simply, as a citizen of the East African community, go and work in Uganda, simply with Tanzania and so on. And I think it's a very efficient way to do so. But this is also linked to the manner in which they have also looked at East African documentation and how they've done it in a manner that they are able to trace the movement of people. In ECOWAS, for example, any citizen of ECOWAS needs to register when they're in one of the countries, you know, inform the local police in some way. Mm-hmm. And this is in order to also ensure that there is a regional movement of people. So instead of shutting down your borders, when you open your borders and you have a better registration of the movement of people, there are ways of tracking it. We were informed at the Inclusive Infrastructure Summit as well that because of some of the challenges around security and insecurity, ECOWAS is going to look at electronic authentication system. I think it's a biometric card, which is like our identity card, and this biometric card will also assist in the movement of people and with their movement across the region, but it will allow them to access services across the countries. And I think we should really look at the lessons that we can learn and look at how we are able to change realities. This morning, I was addressing a meeting of the regional economic communities, the representatives of the gender divisions of the various RECs. And I gave them the example of Congo, DRC, where one of the former governors, a province in the DRC, had actually improved the whole issue of, one road infrastructure, but looked at the greater mobility of goods in that region. And there was quite a reflection on how the domestic product of that region, they really increase their taxation as well as the incomes there. You know, we see that if we're more efficient on the way in which we do things, we have more disposable income and money coming in through taxation in the process as well.
Well, I think you've shared some incredible examples with us in terms of the infrastructure that is underway, all of the efforts that the African Development Bank is currently doing. One area, and we're about to go into the last sort of 5 minutes of the show, is we've spoken about these developments, and you've mentioned the need for communities to come together, for government to come together, and education to help build and drive these issues. From a woman's point of view, in terms of them becoming more inclusive in the engineering of these projects and to reap the financial benefit of building these projects, what, in your opinion, do you think still needs to be done? How can we drive this initiative forwards?
A few things. I mean, I've spoken about some of the challenges in the beginning of this show.
Yes.
I've spoken about projects and what's possible by giving some good examples across. But the reality is that we're still a long way from achieving the levels of infrastructure development required on the continent. We also know that there's a deficit of about $47 billion in terms of attaining Africa's infrastructure, to overcome Africa's infrastructure deficit.
And in that, sorry, in terms of that, the $47 billion, where would that take us to? Is that giving us up to 2020, this would be what we envisage Africa needs, or is it more long-term?
The $47 billion deficit is as is the situation today. So that's just to overcome the infrastructure deficit on the continent, you know? And obviously, it doesn't mean if we get $47 billion today that we're going to overcome that immediately, because we don't have the capacity that's required we don't have all the capacity required to take that forward. So it's going to require the private sector and the public sector to work together to overcome the infrastructure deficit that we see on the African continent right now. And as we do so, I would really like to see that we take into account the human capital that's there at the moment. So without significant political commitment and investment, the infrastructure deficit is just set to deteriorate even further over the next 20 years. And it's one of the most critical challenges facing the continent at the moment. And if you look at, for example, the energy sector, and you look at the current homogeneous composition of the energy sector, particularly at high-level decision-making positions, this must change and it must become more diverse. So there's a need to, and the second part to this response, we must also look at more diverse workforce and infrastructure, and that will only succeed if significant efforts are made to develop a large and growing pool of skilled female and male energy professionals. This will also require efforts to build on the global trends in girls performing better than boys in science and math. And this is, if given the opportunity to encourage more girls to get involved in science, engineering, and maths at all levels of education. Now, there are efforts of NGOs such as the South African-based NGO WOMENG. It's WOMENG. If you look at my Twitter handle, GJFRAF, you'll see a picture with me. I mean, it's a pink hard hat I'm wearing, but this NGO is doing a lot of work to involve women in engineering, and they're not just looking at women training and getting them into universities and so on. They're also looking at guiding women once they're in the workplace. So I think that's important. International agencies such as UNESCO, global engineering institutions, all of them must promote involving women at all levels. And we making a contribution. Again, we're nowhere near solving the problem. I've said earlier, if we don't deal with this now, things will deteriorate even further over the next 20 years. So we need everyone and all hands on deck to make a difference.
Thank you very much. It's been wonderful chatting to you again, as always, and thanks for sharing all of the insights into the new infrastructure development projects that are underway and the need to start the journey now so that we don't end up with greater deficits in terms of our continental infrastructure needs.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Amalaya, and it's always good talking to you and talking on Womanity.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance. And we have been talking to Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi, who is the Special Gender Envoy at the African Development Bank.